Good morning, Auroville. This is Abhijit with you again, broadcasting from Auroville Radio. And I'm back with my series on exploring education in arts, animation, and filmmaking. Today, I bring you another topic in filmmaking. In fact, today I continue from what I discussed in my last filmmaking topic, the pre-World War I European cinema. So I dwelled a little bit into that last time, and this time I'm going to continue and hopefully finish this era in the filmmaking history. So, another area of experiment for Griffith involved camera movement and placement, most of which had been purely functional before him. When Biograph started sending his production unit to Southern California in 1910, Griffith began to practice panoramic panning shots, not only to provide visual information, but also to engage his audience in the total environment of his films. Later, he would prominently employ the tracking or traveling shot, in which the camera and therefore the audience participates in the dramatic action by moving with it. In California, Griffith discovered that camera angle could be used to comment upon the content of a shot or to heighten its dramatic emphasis in a way that the conventionally mandated head-on medium shot could not. And at a time when convention dictated the flat and uniform illumination of every element in a scene, he pioneered the use of expressive lighting to create mood and atmosphere. Like so many of the other devices he brought into general use, these had all been employed by earlier directors, but Griffith was the first to practice them with the care of an artist and to rationalize them within the overall structure of his films. Griffith's one-reelers grew increasingly complex between 1911 and 1912, and he began to realize that only a longer and more expansive format could contain his vision. At first, he made such two-reel films as Enoch Arden in 1911, Man's Genesis in 1912, The Massacre also in 1912, and The Mothering Heart in 1913. But these went virtually unnoticed by a public enthralled with such recent features from the Europe as Queen Elizabeth and Quo Vadis. Finally, Griffith determined to make an epic himself, based on the story of Judith and Holofernes from the Apocrypha. The result was the four-reel Judith of Bethulia in 1913, filmed secretly on a 12-square-mile, that is 31-square-kilometers, set in Chatsworth Park, California. In addition to its structurally complicated narrative, Judith contained the massive sets and battle scenes unlike anything yet attempted in American film. It cost twice the amount Biograph had allocated for its budget. Company officials, stunned at Griffith's audacity and extravagance, tries to relieve the director of his creative responsibilities by promoting him to studio production chief. Griffith quit instead, publishing a full-page advertisement in the New York Dramatic Mirror in December 3, 1913, in which he took credit for all the Biograph films he had made from The Adventures of Dolly through Judith, as well as for the narrative innovations they contained. He then accepted an offer from Harry Atkin, the president of the recently formed Mutual Film Corporation, to head the feature production company Reliance Majestic. He took Bitzer and most of his Biograph company, stock company, with him. As part of his new contract, Griffith was allowed to make two independent features per year, and for his first project, he chose to adapt The Klansman, a novel about American Civil War and Reconstruction by the Southern clergyman Thomas Dixon Jr. Shooting on the film began in secrecy in late 1914, although a script existed, Griffith kept most of the continuity in his head. A remarkable feat considering that the completed film contained 1,544 separate shots, at a time when the most elaborate of foreign spectacles boasted fewer than 100. When the film opened in March 1915, retitled The Birth of a Nation, it was immediately pronounced epoch-making and recognized as a remarkable artistic achievement. The complexity of its narrative and the epic sweep of its subject were unprecedented. But so too were its controversial manipulations of audience response, especially its blatant appeals to racism. Besides its brilliantly conceived battle sequences, its tender domestic scenes, and its dignified historical reconstructions, the film provoked fear and disgust with its shocking images of racial violence. As the film's popularity swept the nation, denunciations followed, and many who had originally praised it, such as the US president himself, at the time Woodrow Wilson, were forced to recant. Ultimately, after screenings of The Birth of a Nation had caused riots in several cities, it was banned in 8 northern and midwestern states. Such measures, however, did not prevent The Birth of a Nation from becoming the single most popular film in history throughout much of the 20th century. It achieved national distribution in the year of its release and was seen by nearly 3 million people. Taking the lead in protesting against The Birth of a Nation, the National Association of Advancement of Colored People, also known as NAACP, which had been founded 6 years prior to the film's release, used the struggle as an organizing tool. The powerful impact of Griffith's film, meanwhile, persuaded many black leaders that racial stereotyping in motion pictures could be more effectively channeled if African-American filmmakers produced works more accurately and fairly depicting black lives. For their first effort, The Birth of a Race, in 1919, black sponsors sought collaboration with white producers but lost control of the project, which was judged a failure. Other aspiring African-American filmmakers took note of the film's problems and began to make their own works independently. The Lincoln Motion Picture Company and the writer and entrepreneur Oscar Michaud were among those who launched what became known as the genre of race pictures produced in and for the black community. Although it is difficult to believe that the racism of The Birth of a Nation was unconscious, as some have claimed, it is easy to imagine that Griffith had not anticipated the power of his own images. He seems to have been genuinely stunned by the hostile public reaction to his masterpiece. And he fought back by publishing a pamphlet entitled The Rise and Fall of Free Speech in America in 1915, which vilified the practice of censorship and especially intolerance. At the height of his notoriety and fame, Griffith decided to produce a spectacular cinematic polemic against which he saw as a flaw in the human character that had endangered civilization throughout history. The result was the massive epic Intolerance in 1916, which interweaves stories of martyrdom from 4 separate historical periods. The film was conceived on a scale so monumental that it dwarfed all its predecessors, cross-cutting freely between a contemporary tale of courtroom injustice, the fall of ancient Babylon to Cyrus the Great in 503 BC, the massacre of Saint Bartholomew's Day in the 16th century France, and the crucifixion of Christ. Griffith created an editing structure so abstract that contemporary audiences could not understand it. Even the extravagant sets and exciting battle sequences could not save Intolerance at the box office. To reduce his losses, Griffith withdrew the film from distribution after 22 weeks. He subsequently cut into the negative and released the modern and the Babylonian story as 2 separate features, The Mother and the Law and The Fall of Babylon in 1919. It would be fair to say that Griffith's career as an innovator of film form ended with Intolerance, but his career as a film artist certainly did not. He went on to direct another 26 features between 1916 and 1931, chief among them the World War I anti-German propaganda epic, Hearts of the World in 1918, the subtle and lyrical Broken Blossoms in 1919, and the rousing melodrama Way Down East in 1920. The financial success of the latter made it possible for Griffith to establish his own studio at Mamaroneck, New York, where he produced epics Orphans of the Storm in 1921 and America in 1924, which focused on the French and American revolutions respectively. Both lost money. Griffith's next feature was the independent semi-documentary Isn't Life Wonderful in 1925, which was shot on location in Germany and is thought to have influenced both the street films of the German director G.W. Pabst and the post-World War II Italian neo-realist movement. Griffith's last films, with the exception of The Struggle in 1931, were all made for other producers. Not one could be called a success, although his first sound film, Abraham Lincoln, in 1930, was recognized as an effective essay in the new medium. The critical and financial failure of The Struggle, however, a version of Emile Zola's The Drunkard, forced Griffith to retire. It might be said of Griffith that the George Méliès and Edwin S. Porter, he outlived his genius. But that is not true. Griffith was fundamentally a 19th century man who became one of the 20th century's greatest artists. Transcending personal defects of vision, judgment, and taste, he developed the narrative language of film. Later filmmakers adapted his techniques and structures to new themes and styles, while for Griffith, his innovations were inextricably linked to a social vision that became obsolete while he was still in the prime of his working life. And that brings us to the end of this episode. Thank you for tuning in.
This is Auroville Radio, voices from the city of Dome.